You tuned in to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. D.C. has long been known as a jazz town, but in recent years, iconic clubs like Bohemian Caverns have closed, and others like Howard Theater have struggled financially. What is the state of jazz today, and how is that reflected in the landscape of live music venues? Joining me to have this conversation is Davey Yarborough. He is the Director of Jazz Studies at Duke Ellington School of the Arts. Davey Yarborough, good to see you again.
Yeah, same here.
Also with us is Amy K. Bormitt. She is a pianist, vocalist, and composer, and the director of the Washington Women in Jazz Festival, the founder of Strange Woman Records, and the host of WPFW's Jazz Stories. Amy K. Bormitt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, DeAndre Howard is the manager of Alice's Jazz and Cultural Society and an old friend. DeAndre, good to see you again.
Good to see you, man. Yes, sir.
Davey, you're a legendary flutist and saxophonist in this town. How did you get your start in the local jazz scene?
The start in the local jazz scene would have been in my senior year in high school when I witnessed my first big band performance under the direction of Bobby Felder, who at that time was the director of music at Federal City College. And like I said, it was the first big band that I'd ever seen live. And of course, I got excited and I went up and talked to him afterwards. And he offered me a scholarship to Federal City College. And
were you playing before that?
I was playing before that. I played rhythm and blues plays, venues. When the clubs used to be called, the clubs being called go-go clubs, which were Masonic Temple and there were quite a few. But eventually the clubs didn't become go-go clubs anymore. It was go-go band. The bands that played became go-go bands. So you can figure out about how long that was.
Yeah.
But I played a lot of the rhythm and blues groups and played a few blues groups before then, but once I got to Federal City College and met Dr. Dawkins, Art Dawkins, and hung out and played with Bobby Felder's band, and met Bill Harris of the Pigfoot, and I can go on and on and on and on and on. And
we don't mind.
And there were all kinds of, matter of fact, I even played with my high school band director, Jesse Adams, at Jackie Lee's Lounge on First Street. And at that time, there were a lot of neighborhood jazz places, and it's part of what we're talking about.
How would
about
you
now.
Describe the scene, say, 30, 40 years ago?
30, 40 years ago, when I first started teaching at Ellington.
Exactly.
It was, as a matter of fact, it was somewhat on the decline, even at that point. You had the larger venues coming in, and a lot of the small places couldn't afford to maintain the live jazz. So, like I said, it was beginning to decline. There are a lot of things that, a lot of issues affected that. I can't remember the year that Vincent Reed, superintendent of the school, relaxed the requirement of having music in all of the secondary schools, and the impact of that, which didn't revert until Dr. Floretta McKenzie came back and reinstated it. But by that time, a lot of things had fallen apart, and they've been trying to rebuild ever since.
Why and when did you leave the nightclub scene?
Ooh, see, why did I leave the nightclub scene? As a part of the results of, what was going on in the city and the places closing down, and the fact that you couldn't really survive as an artist here just on the nightclub scene. But the nightclub scene is grueling. When I started working at one of our old places, Moore's Love and Peace, we were working six nights a week. And we had to work six nights a week to make ends meet. But the venues would actually pay you for working those. And like I said, it wasn't the greatest salary in the world, but eventually the date started, went from six to four to weekends to two to one. But the salaries were not going up when the numbers of days that you were going to be there.
You said you would probably be making less today than you did 30 years ago.
Actually, yes. In some situations, yeah, definitely. Now I'm thinking about it, yeah.
DeAndre, what were local jazz venues like when you first started that? I met DeAndre more than 30 years ago at the aforementioned Moore's Love and Peace restaurant. And that was right down the street from Mr. Wise.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was right down the street from the Pigfoot.
That's correct.
Those are all jazz clubs on that Rhode Island Avenue strip at that time. What were the venues like when you first started out, DeAndre?
To me, they were really hard. Because I come in as a trumpet player, and my brother, he had already been, he's out there, they all knew him. So they're looking at great expectations from me, and I wasn't giving it up. So they were hard, even the club owners, Mr. Moore, Mr. Y, they knew who I was, and they called me Little Joe. But they would, Mr. Y would just say, man, you need to practice, practice. Mr. Moore, you know how he was a little high voice, he would just say something out of high voice and just shake his head and walk away, you know. And so they were hard coming because all the great musicians, like, you know, Shirley Horn would come in the Moores, mm-hmm. Keita Betts, Bill Harris, they would sit right at the table under my horn and look at me and just be shaking their head. I got to keep playing, you know. And then I come off the stage and I tell the story all the time because Shirley Horn said, Little Joe, come here. And I come and she would say, I hear what you're saying, but you ain't saying it yet. And oh man, and Keita would be falling out laughing. Bill, they would all just be cursing me out all the time. But my brother said, because they do that, Mr. Wise, all the places, they say they see potential in you. But coming up, I had it hard, but it was a good hard, you know, because they just stayed on my case. They see me and walk by or come out the stage, they just grunt. And Shirley would have a drink, and she would look at her, she'd look at me and twist her face up, then have a drink of a drink, look back up.
Wearing her dark glasses all the time.
And the dark glasses, then look back up, and then look at her drink and be shaking her head. I mean, Lawrence Wheatley, he'd look over them glasses, you know, because the one step down, I would go up there when you're trying to get your legs, and I was nowhere about the thing. And I get up there and try to play Maurice and them guys. They just, the way they play, they just come and blow and they push you out the way. I mean, they were harsh. And like I tell everybody, the musicians today, I say, if you had to come up when I came up, these cats, they will, the club owners will let you know if you stinking up the place.
Exactly.
You
right.
know, and just hope you get it together, not just stuck with it and listen. And matter of fact, when we first got here, I was telling Dave, me and him played in a band called the Sons of Nature, John Freeman. That's when I first met Dave.
That wasn't a jazz group, but it was headed in that direction.
Exactly.
Well, I always thought you were good, DeAndre. So
Thank you.
Even though I'm not the expert at Shirley Horn, I thought you were good in those days at that time. Amy, you grew up here. You studied with Dave Yarbrough at Duke Ellington. How did the local scene support the start of your career?
Sure. Well, these two guys are two people that I saw a lot growing up here. And I moved to D.C. actually to study with Mr. Yarbrough when I went to Duke Ellington. I had been living in Oregon, and my father was living out here, and he said, you got to check out this spot. I heard about this Duke Ellington School of the Arts. And I'm like, I'm sorry, they named a school after Duke Ellington? I'm very intrigued by this. And so I came up there and had an audition, and he was like, yeah, you want to come play in the band? Come hang out. Come every day. You can play jazz with us. And I was like, oh. So that was, you know, I have sort of a hybrid education because I had at the base of all this this music making a foundation of music education that was just absolutely fabulous. I went to Duke Ellington School of the Arts. I went to University of Michigan and studied with Jerry Allen. And then I came back here and went to Howard University with Fred Irby and Charlie Young and all the wonderful people over there. So I have this hybrid where I'd have a music education foundation that I think a lot of jazz musicians who are playing now who are in their 20s and 30s have that background that they really learned to play the music in school. But at the same time, Dave Yarbrough was, you know, taking us out to play gigs when we were at Ellington all the time. So we had, you know, we had to bring all the equipment. And we joked about, you know, the elevator broke. The building now is gorgeous. But back in the day, the elevator broke because it caught on fire. And so one day I had to carry the bass drum. There was no, you know, no supposition for the fact that I was a girl carrying the bass drum in like 3-inch crushed velvet leather shoes. And I went down the stairs just with the bass drum and just, you know, it was really exciting. It was an exciting time to.
You mean you rolled down the stairs with the bass drum?
I did, with the bass drum. So it was, you know, it was good for me. I never had much of an ego going in, so it wasn't too much of a problem, thank God. But, Yeah, we drug all our equipment around on a tiny little bus and played all over town. And I started going out to HR 57, which is, you know, back in the day had lots of jam sessions when I was in high school with my friend Herb Scott, who now runs the Capitol Hill Jazz Jazz Foundation. And we would play down there, and then I eventually ended up getting a gig down there. I played Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then after that show was over, we'd go up to U Street and hang out at Utopia with DeAndre and cause trouble, and it'd be some hot summer nights hanging out on the street. And just remembering very clearly on U Street when they stopped, when they put in the smoking ban, and all the people would come out of Cafe Nima and Twins, and just everybody, all the jazz musicians are smoking on the street. I think it's been a good thing they put in that smoking ban, because I've seen a lot less smoking in the jazz community.
You made a few references that I got to clarify. H.R. 57 was actually the name of a bill that Congressman John Conyers had introduced into the House of Representatives having to do with jazz. And you mentioned Jerry Allen, who inspired so many people here for so long, who we lost last year, I think it was. Jerry Allen, and she will definitely be missed. But there are others who want to join this conversation. Here's Benji in Northern Virginia. Benji, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. It's great to be on the air. I really love everyone who's in the studio right now.
Go right ahead, Benji.
Mutual.
My question is, I'm a high school senior and an amateur jazz musician from Northern Virginia, and I was just wondering if me and others listening could hear some places that me and others could go to find, like, jam sessions or just to play with people.
Well, I know that there's a jam session at Tacoma Station. I think it's on Tuesday night starting around 7 o'clock. You might want to try your hand there. Mm-hmm. These others might be able to tell you about some other places.
There's a great resource in D.C. called Capital Bop, capitalbop.com, and they have a listing of all the jazz events that are happening in the city. And two they will definitely have on there that I love, two of my favorite jam sessions, are Wednesday nights at Mr. Henry's, is the Capitol Hill Jazz Jam. And that's from 8 to 11, and there's no cover. Just come through and buy some nachos. And and then Sundays is the D.C. Jazz Jam, and that also has no cover. So that's a little bit earlier. I think it's 6:30 to 9:30. So both of those, actually, this next week will be taken over by the Washington Women in Jazz Festival.
We'll talk about that.
Which is my festival. So you'll see a lot of lovely women will be out there playing all the instruments, but you are more than welcome to come because it's an open jam session. So.
And we at Jack's, we are starting, this is our second month, we have a C3 organization. We hire them and they do spoken word and open mic for jazz. And then a lot of people don't know about Columbia Station up there with Peter Elderman.
Yeah.
He's on Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah.
So it's quite a bit of jazz jam sessions in the city. And this is the beginning over at Alice's Jazz and Cultural Society. We kick this off, and then we have one that's going to be exclusively jazz. And we're hoping to pour the great piano players in there, you know, to host that.
Benji, thank you very much for your call. You two can send us a tweet at Kojo Shore, email to Kojo at WAMU.org. How do you think D.C.'s jazz culture compares to other cities? 800-433-8850. And then there's another venue that we have to mention, but I think I will let Dick Smith do that.
Yeah.
Dick Smith, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, wow. I'm sitting here listening. I feel like a dinosaur.
No, but you're not.
You ain't, man.
I really feel like a dinosaur. Because when I came to Washington to play football, and I came in the 60s. So, and I guess my first year here was around 67. And Bobby Mitchell took me, who was a football player, a Hall of Famer. He took me down to a place down on 7th Street. And I met Mary Jefferson, was playing.
My girl. Used to be my neighbor.
Peter Best, and it was John Malachi.
Wow.
And it was a guy named, it was Mary's husband, Mark Hill.
Yep.
Playing drums, and he was playing in this little place. And I was singing a little bit. I thought I was a little singer, but I didn't know how far out of tune I was. Especially for jazz, because jazz was a very sophisticated culture. And so after that, after meeting those people, I met most of the people who did jazz in the town, like Rick Henderson and Hilton Felton. And I knew Shirley Horn, Bill
Harris.
Bill Harris? Harris.
Mm-hmm. And then I played them. So I started playing at these clubs. I even played for a while. I played the Cellar Door, mm-hmm. and then Blues Alley. Right. I did Cafe La Trac. I did just about every jazz club because I was doing jazz with guys like Ellsworth Gibson.
Yeah.
So I worked with Ellsworth for a very long, long time. And he played everywhere. There was a lot of – Washington is a particular type of town. Most of the jazz guys who were working, they the union was – it was separated. It was two unions. It was a white one and a black one. And so they finally kind of merged together, and they were getting jobs that way. And a lot of guys worked private gigs because D.C. was loaded with private things. Mm-hmm. Then I became part of an organization called Let 'Em Play, which was run by a guy named Tony Taylor.
Yeah, Mary Jefferson was a part of that, too.
A lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was on the board for, I think, I forgot what year, because I don't even want to try that.
But tell us what you're doing now.
Well, I'm at Westminster Church now. Mm-hmm. It was like a spinoff. We were looking for a place to play and trying to preserve the music. And I think our mission more is a cultural thing. We're trying to build a community. A lot of musicians, they're young and they want to play. They're looking for gigs. And we really didn't start with gigs. We existed because jazz musicians just wasn't getting paid. I mean, they were doing jam sessions and all that. A lot of that was going on. But they were going to places playing private gigs, and then they were doing the prison, and Tony had them all over. But at Westminster, we got in a program with Brian Hamilton, and the church was real good. And we started off with something that we were actually paying guys for the gig to do jazz. Yeah. And so that's basically...
And Westminster Church is on 6th Street Southwest.
On 6th Street, yeah.
6th Street Southwest, and it's generally crowded.
Fourth
Street Southwest.
Yeah, fourth
and I Southwest. And mm-hmm. It's generally
been there
crowded.
This is our 20th year. Mm-hmm.
Yep, been going on for 20 years. Dick, thank you very much for your call.
All right.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation on jazz venues. We got an email from Roger who says, "Personally, I'm a jazz fan and I own a number of recordings from the 1920s and 30s. That said, if we turn back the clock 200 years, we would find Washington full of harpsichord music and people dancing the minuet. Times change, tastes change." I'm Kojo Namdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. We're talking about jazz in Washington and venues yesterday and today. We're talking with Davey Yarbrough. He's the director of jazz studies at Duke Ellington School of the Arts. DeAndre Howard is the manager of Alice's Jazz and Cultural Society. They are both musicians, of course. And Amy K. Bormitt is a pianist, vocalist, and composer. She directs the Washington Women in Jazz Festival and founder of Strange Woman Records. She also hosts WPFW's Jazz Stories. Amy, you were talking about when you came here, Duke Ellington High School, Davey Yarbrough taking you guys out on gigs, you rolling down the stairs with the drum. But
obviously, good visual.
Obviously, there was a lot of support in those days. How do you compare the support you had then with now?
I mean, for me personally, I still feel like there's a ton of support for jazz and for great instrumental music and vocal music here in D.C. So I think with the last 10 years or so, I've seen an upswell of support in the ability of the jazz community to connect online and to inform each other about what's happening on the scene. With CapitalBop.com and their event listings, I've seen a lot of support for people coming out to shows, working with the Washington Women in Jazz Festival. I've seen just tons and tons of different people who are moving into the city and are interested in the music. And I think that D.C. has sold You know, you watch these DC cool videos they put up online. They've sold the city as a hip place to go see music and to see performers. And I think there's a certain flexibility that we've been having. We have to play in different places because Bohemian Caverns isn't around anymore. You know, we're going to have to play down the street in a different spot, or, you know, in DuPont Circle at a bistro, or wherever we can get it in. But wherever the music happens in the city, it's really top level, and I think people really, really enjoy it.
You mentioned D.C. promoting itself as a jazz city. Here's a clip from the district's tourism campaign asking the question, what is D.C. cool?
Like salsa and jazz and rock all night, from twilight's last gleaming to the dawn's early light. It's the Caverns where Louis, Miles, and the Duke have all played.
Now, how has the scene changed most drastically? You talked about when you could walk from, I guess, U Street over to Adams Morgan and run into a whole lot of venues. How has that changed? And I'll ask all of you the same question.
Yeah, for me, starting out, that was my first introduction to really meeting as many people as possible, was walking down U Street on a Thursday night and popping into spots and seeing who was doing what and sitting in with people and talking to people. And that's actually how I met one of my favorite musicians, Gabrielle Murphy, was because I went to see DeAndre and he was like, yo, this girl, you guys are both girls. And I was like, yeah, I'm so, I was just like, yeah, but y'all can really play. And I was like, thank you, you know. And so then he pulled her out of Utopia. She was playing a solo. After the solo, he pulled her out under U Street and was like, look, you need to be friends.
Hired her all the time.
Right. And now we work together all the time. She's up in New York. And, you know, these types of things led to a really groundswell of people just being able to meet each other and network and talk face to face. And I think that has kind of faded a little bit because of the lack of a concentrated area of jazz clubs. But I do see it happening online. I do see people coming out to jam sessions. You know, Mr. Henry's on Wednesday nights is always popping with a lot of musicians coming there. And so there's these spots that musicians still come out and congregate. But it's a different thing when everybody had their gigs lining up and down the street. Who's playing at Twins? Who's playing at NEMA? Who's playing at Utopia? You know, who's playing at JoJo's? Who's playing at HR57? Who's playing at Bohemian Caverns? Like, up, you know, up and down the whole street, Dukem, all these, you know, this area of Ethiopian restaurants where it seemed like every single restaurant had jazz in it. So that's difficult without having that. But now I think that things are hopefully are starting to pick back up for our community.
Dave, have you seen the scene change?
Actually, with the onset of the generation with Amy and a few others, that became the upswing. And it's ebbed and flowed. And like I said, it's hopefully it's on the incline again. And we, you know, we talk about the Bohemian Caverns and the history behind it, which I think is paramount in terms of assisting the
We're going to talk in a little bit about what your plans are for Bohemian Cavern, what you're doing with that.
Yeah, that whole history, going back to the days when that club was so hot, there was a lot. Like I said, it declined, and now it's with jazz actually getting into the educational institutions, it has helped because we can expose the young people. We can continue to expose the young people, but we still have ebb and flow with that as well because the educational system doesn't really, with the, I guess, the advent of STEM and the battle with STEAM, does not see as much importance of the arts in terms of total education. So hopefully that's on the upswing as well. But I think documentation and promotion and preservation are going to assist in that as well.
Well, for me, from the old days to the present, with the clubs, like when they was all, like Amy said, where they were all close by, you know, the late Roy Hargrove, and when he would come to town when the Utopia still open, he'd go by HR, come by NEMA, everybody, Utopia, and then at the end, when we would finish up at 2:30, Bohemian had a jam session that started, what, about 3? And that reminded me of the old days. But then after the Utopia closed down, then Bohemian, when Cafe NEMA, because like she said, it reminded me a back day when I was coming up with those Moors and Lanises, those places. And, you know, HR 57, well, they weren't there yet, but you had a place when your gig ended, you could go to someone else's gig
more.
And meet, yep, and meet other musicians. And like she said, when I met her and Gabrielle, you know, and met Reginald Sinje when he came into town, because he walked into Utopia, and when the cats walk from the horn or something, or somebody walk in, I'm the old guy now, so I'll do what the old guy say to me. I say, can you play that thing in your horn case? And the first day, Reggie started laughing and stuff, you know, and I say, come on, play. I say, take your horn out. And cats thought it was a jam session, but it wasn't a jam session. It was my gig, but I know so many people, and I would allow them to play. And so many, I met so many of Dave's students. They come up and say, well, Mr. Yarbrough told me to come by here. Who's DeAndre? I said, I'm DeAndre. I say, come on, play, sing, and do something. So, but the scene has now died out again. But you need, it's still here, but you need more places. That's why we over at Alice's are getting ready to implement some jam sessions, because you need more places to have that jam session so the cats, and open to the cats, so they will feel they can come in and sit in.
What about the financial picture for musicians today, Davey Yarbrough?
What I've always taught at Arlington was when you're an artist, you have to be creative in terms of how you plan your survival in your career. And from my experience with what was going on in the nightclubs, and all the time during that time, once I started teaching, it was a lot easier for me because I had another outlet, but I was teaching the music. I was teaching jazz. And so I stayed abreast of what was going on. I had to stay current because I had to show the students what, you know, that the old man could do a little bit of what he's trying to tell them to do. But at the same time, I could tell them about the industry and tell them about the business end, which really wasn't promoted a lot, even on the college level, that there are several ways for you to make a living in the arts, and it's not always just about being on the stage and playing. So when you talked about composing and protecting your work, when you started, and just like Amy has started to Washington Women in Jazz, organizations in support of, again, you don't have to totally leave your area, but you can do that as well, because we knew people like Larry Ennett and Dick Morgan who were doctors and lawyers, but they were consummate musicians. Yeah. So what I was trying to do, what I have been trying to do at Ellington and still today, is show that a young person has more options now than they did before. And we just want to make sure that they take a path that will allow them to sustain themselves while they enjoy and recreate this art. Mm-hmm.
Okay, a few more people want to join this conversation. Here is Jay in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Jay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to mention how the audiences have changed at the clubs, where they don't really want to listen to the music anymore. There's just constant talking, and it's really disturbing. And it's not just jazz clubs. So Hamilton has gone that way. HR 57 it was always like that, I guess. But it's just disturbing, and I used to go to clubs way more than I do now, but it's mainly because of that conversation going on.
Well, you won't find anyone drinking alcohol at Alice's.
That's right.
Alice's, and that's one of the reasons why you probably won't hear a whole lot of talking
at
Alice's.
Can I speak on that?
Yes.
Okay, for the caller, that's why we built Alice, because from the years of my playing, I'd be in the club, the smoke, I'm playing my horn, they sitting around me blowing smoke right in my face, I'm aware of it, and the drinking, people get to talking and hollering at the women. So here, all the patrons always laugh because the women come in and say, I noticed, because they know what I stress. I don't have to get up on the stage and say, please hold your conversations to a minimum, because they know it's a listening room. People come into Alice, it's a beautiful place. It's set up for jazz music. And we sell the dinners and all that jazz, but you come in and you can sit and hear the music. Last night we had Lionel Lyles and his quintet there doing their original straight ahead jazz. Packed house, the people loved it. So you come, our pitch, you come to Alice Jazz and Cultural Society, you will hear every nuance of the music.
You can also do that at Westminster Church.
Yes.
Also, you won't hear a whole lot of talking there. But the changes that we're talking about, what's the blame for these changes? Is it the rising cost of rent? Is it the pushing out of longtime residents, or a combination of all of those?
All of them.
Well, wow. I think it happened long before that. I hear people talking about gentrification. But I don't think that that's the deal in Washington, D.C. I hit on a little bit on the fact that the education system backed off the promotion of arts, as well as when that happened, also the culture changed a little bit. The street culture changed a little bit. I mean, prior to the Sons of Nature, mm-hmm. I could walk from Blair Road to 16th Street up to Silver Spring with my horn in my hand, going to a rehearsal or something like that. Like I said, culture changed a little bit, and the combination of watering down the arts programs in the schools, and then the fact that an artist must have their instrument at home and at school. And when the schools no longer felt it safe enough to let the students take instruments home, those who could not afford instruments no longer had a vehicle to practice with, and let alone even private lessons. Parents get instruments and say, oh, no, you can't take that to school because you might get robbed on the way back and forth or whatever. It could get damaged. Mm-hmm. You could leave it on the bus, all of these type of things. So a young person who doesn't have consistent access, and that's when they can study and go home and practice what they've been learning and come back and bring a product they develop. That development process has been seriously scarred. Support, the only way to counter that is that you have a way that their instruments at the school and instruments at home.
I was going to ask this question, but I'll let Giovanni in Washington ask it. Giovanni, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Giovanni Rusinello. I'm with Capital BOP, and I'm grateful that Amy's mentioned us a couple times and grateful to this whole panel that you guys are bringing up so many of these salient issues. The breadth of, like, kind of community thinking between the three of you is amazing, and I kind of wanted to touch on that. How would you say that the city can go about supporting artists like yourselves who are not just musician practitioners but are actually organizers? And I think there's a deep, long-standing tradition of that in jazz. As the pianist Vijay Iyer says, the history of jazz musicians is a history of community organizing. So it's beautiful to hear from, and I think Kojo, I salute you for choosing these three people who are leaders of organizations but are also themselves musicians. How can the city go about supporting people like yourselves in building community around the music, welcoming audiences in, new and old?
Especially since you just heard the clip that the city promotes itself as being a jazz city, do you think the city needs to be offering more support to
yes,
jazz musicians?
Definitely. I think that what I'd like to see is just direct money being given to jazz musicians, being given to jazz organizations in the city, without these hoops of trying to fit into some sort of grant that might not fit what they have already presented. The artists have come up with creative ideas. Women come up to me every year with creative ideas that they want to do at the Washington Women in Jazz Festival, and I have to find creative ways to support that. And what I'd like to see is the city just saying, yes, that's a good idea, here's some money. And I think that it becomes increasingly difficult when you're trying to compete against several different other worthy organizations in the city, that they need to take the time aside and say, this is what jazz has brought to D.C., and we want to support that. So I'd love to see some funding set aside just for jazz musicians directly.
And I would like to see, I'm not going to get real political, but what I see in the city with the music, the people who have the money, they pick and choose what places they want to support. And at Alice Jazz and Cultural Society, the people need, instead of picking themselves, they need to talk, get a panel like these cats, and get the musicians, talk to the musicians, get their ideas, because they're the ideas that the people with the money come up with, I don't agree with any of them. You know, we haven't got no support. The support we get from Alice is from the people who donate and the people who come there.
Yep.
We got one grant at the beginning, and it was the less grant possible. And and Dr. Alice would always say, why'd they do that? I say, because to break it down, every city has a clique, and the musicians aren't clicking. I mean, the musicians, we all get along. So they need to have a panel and get some musicians and presenters of the music to do, like I do. I promote, at Alice's, I talk about where you can go hear other jazz. I name all the other clubs because nobody's in competition, because we are all jazz clubs.
Also, politically, when you're talking how can the city, The city is going to respond, and I think they will respond. Our elected officials will respond when we can make enough noise that they actually get a chance to hear it. So we have to be active as artists in going downtown and sitting in on sessions and also having forums like this. Kojo, I have to salute you for having this forum that allows our voices to be heard. But I think the louder we can get our voices heard, the better the chances of these things happening.
Got to take a short break. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. We're talking jazz venues in Washington. And before we go to the phones, I have to talk a little bit with my guests about exactly what they're working on right now. Amy, you founded the Washington Women in Jazz Festival, which is taking place in the city even as we speak. How have you incorporated atypical venues and up-and-coming musicians in the lineup?
That's been my number one goal, is to try to increase the jazz audience and also bring some visibility to the women who are out here playing in the scene. I've done a lot of things for that. The Young Artist Showcase has advanced high school students and college students, women that are performing together. And we do 2 days of workshops and business workshops and panel discussions and rehearsals groups together. And it's a great experience. So that'll be next week. We have just a whole myriad selection of events. We go all over town into little places, big places, concert venues. Tonight we'll be at the Kennedy Center Millennium Stage at 6 p.m. But next week, we'll be at a tiny spot called Spacey Cloud in Adams Morgan, which is a woman-owned art gallery and vegan restaurant. And we'll be playing some experimental music down there. So it's the full gamut of activities.
March 10th through the 31st. DeAndre, yes. You're still performing, but your big thing, and I was managing Alice's Jazz and Cultural Society. What makes it different from almost every other jazz venue in the city?
Well, the sea, because I'm an old cat, and I'm the one who built it. And Alice had the dream since she's a little girl, and I had the dream at Moore's Love and Peace, 27 years old, when I told everybody.
He was the youngest person in the joint.
Yeah, exactly. And I told everybody I want to open up a non-alcoholic jazz club. And it's the 70s. They looking at me like, huh? What are you talking about? It didn't ever work. I knew it worked. But the plan, is to keep bringing jazz music where people can access and hear the music, and trying to get, I get over flooded with all the musicians, because I know so many people and they all want to play and I want them all to play, but I don't call myself a booking agency. I call myself a program director, because I sit back and listen to music when I get time, and then that tells me who I should bring in, so I'm not bringing in three groups back to back who are all in the same type thing. I want to mix it up, give you those extensions. We bring you guitar trio, organ trios, and then sometime quintet, in the orchestra. We had Bethesda. We can maybe bring them back, Bethesda Blues Youth Orchestra. Then me and Dave been playing tag for the last 5 years, because he got progress, want to bring in, and we want to do that. But he supposed to call me, or I call him, we supposed to call back, and we never meet up. But stay tuned. We have plenty of things happening, a lot of children programs.
Tell our audience who Alice is and how you two met fortuitously.
We met because I moved back to D.C. and I was doing the Utopia, staying with my sister, Ikea, Quanah Jordan.
Yep.
Staying with her for a year. Then I was going to go down the country and buy me a nice house and just chill out. So I was building a storm, blew the window out. It was building was abandoned. So I get home about 4 o'clock, 5 in the morning. Sis say, bro, you need to go around the corner. Lady needs your help. I say, man, I'm tired of helping people. I got to get some sleep today. She said, you better go. So I got up, went around there. And Alice saw me. She said, oh, we know him. He's DeAndre. Because they see me at Westminster playing all the time. So she said, show me one. I said, yeah, I went to the store with my car, got some wood and boarded it up. Then she showed me the building. And I said, what you trying to do with this building? She said, my dream is to open up a non-alcoholic jazz club. I did like Fred Sanford, grabbed my heart, went back. She thought I was having a heart attack. She said, what's wrong? I said, that's been my dream my whole life. So she said, well, I own the building. We are partners. We have founded it. And Dr. Alice, she is Dr. Alice. She's been ill. She had a stroke 2 weeks before Christmas. But I'm going to see her down the street since she's in this assistant place, and she's doing much better. The last 2 days I talked to her, she's talking to me like she used to. Made
That's
me cry.
How the place came to be. Davey, you're retiring this Friday. What made you decide to go into music education? Why didn't instructing the next generation become so important to you?
Like from my own personal background and the exposure that I had, my exposure came from home. There were records in the house, and I was pretty much self-taught until I met Bobby Felder. But I was playing, and I was playing in bands, you know, by ear. And it was Bobby Felder, as a matter of fact, who conned me.
Into going to Federal City College?
No. Oh. I went to Federal City College, and I said, I get my associate's degree, and I'm out. You know, my parents would be happy I went to college, and I'm going to go out and I'm going on the road, right? Well, when I got my degree, Bobby came and a whole lot of the other faculty pulled me into their office one by one and said, look, you're on scholarship. You're on the dean's list. And you're halfway through to a bachelor's, which you could do a whole lot more with. And they, as a matter of fact, the question was, well, what can you do with an associate's that you couldn't do with your high school diploma? And I couldn't answer the question. And that's how they got me. And so from there, and they said, well, look, you can finish up. And so I thought, I said, okay, I can handle two more years. And I got my education degree. But in that process, I had the opportunity of doing practicums and practice teaching. And my first practicum, I had a serious breakthrough with a kid who was frustrated and ended up wrapping his flute around a chair. I'll never forget that. And behind, I was looking the other way and turned around. And I asked him what happened. He said, oh, no. And as young people will do, but as we finished talking, he had been experienced a lot of frustration because he just wasn't moving like he wanted to. Well, long story short, we got him another instrument. About a month later, he came into my class with the biggest smile on his face you could ever imagine. And he said, look, Mr. Yarbrough, I can do this. And that gleam, that's what caught me. And from there, a lot of other factors made me, one, want to teach, two, and want to stay and watch what's going on. 40 years later, I'm sitting next to Amy Bormann, and I'm hearing her talk about Herb Scott and a bevel of, I mean, just a large amount. I can't tell you how many of the students that are a part of the legacy that was instilled in me. I am a product of the legacy of all those people, the Bill Harrises and the Billy Taylors and the Charlie Hamptons, and I can go on, we won't do that right now. But I stand on their shoulders, and their charge to me was, pass it on.
Love me some Charlie Hampton. Yep. Now that you're looking at retirement, the Bohemian Caverns is closed. What's the big passion project you're working on over at Bohemian Caverns?
Well, we're actually closing the door. I'm closing the door on the high school teaching realm, because those same 40 years of commitment to the ones that have graduated, they are beginning to take over and bring in the new life. My objective now is to maintain, preserve the history and the legacy that I have lived for and from. So that it's accessible and more accessible to Washington, D.C. So one of the initiatives, for the last 20 years, I've been operating the Washington Jazz Arts Institute. My wife and I founded it in 1998. And our mission is to make sure that any kid, once they decide that they want to learn jazz, will have an opportunity and a support system throughout retirement. Part of that, the biggest part of that right now, this came as I spoke a dream. And it was blogged, and the Washington Business Journal called and put out an article, because I said, one, Bohemian Caverns should be designated a historic landmark, and two, it's a building that could also house a museum about Washington jazz artists, I can start phase two of the Washington Jazz Arts Institute mentoring program, making that actual building now contribute to the present, past, and future of jazz in Washington, D.C.
Great idea. Here is Attila in Alexandria, Virginia. Attila, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo.
Hi, Attila.
I'm so happy I get through. This is Attila. Hello, Amy. I'm Sophie's daddy.
Hi. Oh, we had such a good time at the Washington Jazz Arts Institute with Sophie, and she'll be on the Young Artist Showcase again on the 23rd at Public Playhouse. I can't wait.
Yes, and I just wanted to thank everybody from the bottom of my heart for doing such a great job in the BC area, and we cannot be more proud, and that's all I wanted to say. Just keep up the good job, and this is a great shout-out. That's all.
Thank you very much for your call. Here is Dick in Washington, D.C. Dick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. I'm going to show my age because when I was in mid-1950s, I was introduced to jazz at a venue called Olivia Davis's Patio Lounge, which was located on 13th Street. And every Saturday, they would have a matinee where just about every jazz combo, well-known jazz combo, appeared. And for a cover charge and a minimum, they serve you Cokes and pizza. But I saw Gene Krupa and Jerry Mulligan and Art Tatum and Louis Armstrong and just about every famous jazz group at the time. And it set me straight for the rest of my life on my...
That's why Dick Kaufman sings jazz today, Dick. I had to bust you out. Dick, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you, Kojo.
Here is Patrick in Northwest Washington. Patrick, your turn.
Well, you know, there was a time that you really didn't have to come home here in Washington, D.C. You could just go out and listen to music and keep going. And you'd be out there for days, you know. You could find something to do every night. Yep. You could have a blast. But, you know, as I see it with going to the venues, number one, I do drive, and I don't want to get ticketed, so I hope this is one way that, you know, the city can work with the jazz clubs, is not to ticket us patrons who come and park there. The other part is that I've understood about jazz is you got to be brave, you know. Go ahead and let it play. There's beautiful jazz that I could hear on a Sunday afternoon underneath the bridge by the Department of Labor by a security guard who opens up his car doors, has a beautiful stereo, and boy, he plays some good music.
So you got to find it where you can. Running out of time very quickly, but Mauricio tweets, I've owned Cha-Cha on U Street for over 22 years. We stopped live music because it became too expensive to pay musicians and the neighborhood kept complaining about noise. The noise experience we had when we did, we went in front of the Capitol One Arena on 7th Street Northwest and did a pop-up with street musicians there. They're having the same problem, complaints about noise. I know it's something that you're familiar with, Amy.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's two things that are really, we're trying to address that issue. And number one, the being able to pay musicians properly. We just have been working on legislation to get a bonus, a tax rebate for venues that support multiple hours of live music per week. So therefore, hopefully we'll see some kickbacks for the jazz musicians on the scene because we're looking out for our venues and we love and support all of them.
Amy K. Bormitt, DeAndre Howard, Davey Yarborough, thank you all for joining us
and
good luck to all of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Today's show on DC's Jazz Scene was produced by Ruth Tam. We asked today's guests for songs that represent the future of DC's jazz scene. You can listen to their selections at kojoshow.org/blog. It's all part of our series on gentrification in DC's arts community, culminating in a roadshow tomorrow at Arena Stage. If you didn't RSVP, you can still add your name to the wait list at kojoshow.org/20 or listen to the excerpt that we will air at noon on Thursday. Coming up tomorrow, we'll do a deep dive into the future of Maryland's public school system. What are the state's priorities and how will they be funded? That all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorff, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.